This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Free speech, as enshrined in the First Amendment, is central to what many of us consider to be the American experience. But the debate over the limits of free speech has been ignited by how the use of social media contributed to the January 6 riot and violent attack on the U.S. Capitol. To better understand this issue and the rise of misinformation and conspiracy theories, I spoke with Magdalena Wojciechak, professor of communication at UC Davis, and Nella Van Dyke, professor of sociology at UC Merced.
So there's been a lot in the news about this idea of deplatforming or taking away someone's access to social media. Obviously, Twitter's decision to suspend President Trump's account following the Capitol insurrection has made this topic front and center. And many are framing it as a free speech issue. Nella, I'm going to direct this question to you. Is it?
Well, it is a free speech issue, but the fact is that in the United States, private companies and other private entities, including colleges and universities, do not legally have to allow free speech. So private entities have to follow the law, but they don't have to follow provisions that are directly in the Constitution and are not reflected in laws elsewhere.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the divisiveness that we are living through. And Magdalena, you know, for so many years, the press was in this awkward position where they would report what President Trump had said and then go back and fact check the information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard from people, you know, I teach at a community college and I've had students say to me, you know, the president says the media is lying. The media says the president's lying. They're probably both lying. So I'm not going to believe anybody. Can you just talk about the effect of that strategy and how it is contributing to the polarization we are now experiencing?
This tendency is embedded in journalistic practice, right? We need to give equal voice to both sides of a controversy and cover different aspects of an issue. And that sometimes leads to this false balance in which groups or individuals in society who are not the majority or may not even have scientific or factual or expert knowledge are given airtime, legacy media, and spread their information and sometimes misinformation. That was very visible with debates on climate change, in which climate skeptics were given the same airtime as scientists who are showing that it's a man-made phenomenon. And the same goes for President Trump, that very often the media would report certain unverified information that he had disseminated on Twitter, for instance, or any other misinformation, not by the president, and then debunk it on air. And this is absolutely terrible from a social scientific perspective, because A, not only are you giving larger audiences or, you know, kind of free platform to misinformation or unverified information, and therefore you're spreading this information to people who would otherwise not even hear it. But also, even when debunked, misinformation has lingering effects. So people are likely to not really believe, but remember and be affected by the first piece of information that they heard, which could be misinformation, and may not be as likely to remember the correction, because correction is typically much more factual, much more complex than the clickbaity piece of misinformation that may be corrected. So there is a lingering effect. And that also, as you say precisely about your students, that can have this longer term negative systemic effect on decreasing people's trust in media in general. Because when the reality is so complex that, you know, everybody says everybody else is lying, I will not trust anybody and I will not even tune to news media at all. So I think that this journalistic practice is very, very detrimental to the health of society and to individual attitudes and knowledge.
Nella Van Dyke, I'd love to give your take on this.
I
was just going to ask, given your perspective as a sociologist, what is your take on this topic?
Well, I think Magdalena has it 100% correct. And what I would add is that this whole problem is exacerbated by social media. So the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter have algorithms that guide what information gets pushed and kind of placed on people's homepages. And those algorithms favor and prioritize information that causes strong emotions and information from like-minded people that people already agree with. So the effect then of if you have disinformation occurring in the, you know, regular news media, and then people are going on social media and promoting false stories, conspiracy theories, whatever it is, those kind of stories tend to evoke strong emotions, which then gets them pushed by the media companies on the other people's homepages or news feeds, which then makes people think, oh, wow, they get upset. They're seeing repeated messages that repeat the same misinformation. And they're seeing that, again, because it evokes strong emotions and their friends agree with it. They start to think, oh, wow, look at all of this. This must be true. And people do have a tendency to, or, you know, a predisposition to believe information they see that they already agree with. And so it just amplifies the misinformation.
Magdalena, I have to turn the conversation back to you because I would imagine you have more to say about this. What can we do to get out of those echo chambers, mm-hmm. particularly in social media?
That's a wonderful question. And I want to answer first saying that, A, political content or sociopolitical content is a tiny, tiny fraction of people's online exposures. So in one big study I did where I collected online browsing history of individuals, we found that only 2% of the content that people were accessing on their computers for 90 days was news. 2%. Everything else was, you know, email, weather, cats, food recipes, pornography. So most people are uninterested in politics and they do not attend to politics either, you know, in their browser or on social media. And those people who are interested and are using social media for political information or discussion are really unlikely to be in echo chambers. So echo chambers are a reality. I also have a big paper on that. But they pertain to a very, very small subset of a population. So those people are very politically active, very politically interested, and they have much stronger and more extreme political views, stronger partisanship and ideology, for instance. So I want to mention that our big and outrageous concerns about misinformation or echo chambers only pertain to a very small subset of the American population. And then getting out of those, right? Even if it is a small subset, it is important to break those and peer echo chambers and pierce those filter bubbles, because when it comes to, let's say, anti-vaccine movement, those echo chambers can have very detrimental effects and cause lives. But the people who are in those echo chambers and hold very, very strong views are the individuals who are the least likely to want to get out, right? They are very happy in their like-minded bubble where their views are reinforced and confirmed. So here, some algorithmic solutions could be put into place, but that's, of course, the job of the platforms or regulations that would require platforms to tweak the algorithm. But again, the people who are most likely to be in echo chambers are the least likely who want to get out of echo chambers. For those of us who are living in echo chambers, in that, let's say, most of our friends are Facebook or people on Twitter are of our respective ideologies or views, we can diversify our exposures by, you know, following news media organizations from the other side, for instance, or liking those pages on Facebook, and then, you know, the algorithm will work in a way that we will see the content from those pages. But then again, that's a very few people who are following news media pages to begin with, and even fewer who are willing to do what I just described and broaden their news exposure. Again, because most people don't care, others don't have the time, the resources, and so forth.
And I think most of us like to be right and like to be agreed with and don't want to be challenged. You know, I certainly relate to that. Nella, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Something I've been thinking about a lot lately is it seems like if you look back at human history, For most of it, the problem was not enough access to information. Now I feel like we're dealing with the effects of an excess of information. How do you think this over-access of information has contributed to the political moment we're living in right now?
Well, I think over-access, like the fact that we have access to so much information, makes it really difficult for people to filter and to know which sources of information they can trust. And so that's why I think it becomes all the more important that in, you know, our K through 12 education and in higher education, that we teach students and people to know what to look for and to know how to evaluate the quality of the information sources they're seeing. One thing I wanted to add in terms of how we can combat this is there's research that finds that when extreme right violence or the messages from extreme right groups is supported in the media by public figures, including politicians, but also media figures, that that leads to more extremist violence. And so it's very important that we have people, again, politicians, but also media figures, anyone in the public view, denouncing both extremist violence and extremist viewpoints that are objectionable and harmful. And so that is something you like to see happening, because again, when we don't counter it and we just kind of let it go, it spreads and it gets magnified.
Magdalena, I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether or not this moment that we're in was an inevitability, or is it really a function of actions that were taken deliberately by social media companies to put us into these tribes?
That's a great question. And I wouldn't go as far saying that those were kind of deliberate actions. As was mentioned earlier, that social media want our attention and want us to spend time on the platform. And it is the case that clickbaity and emotion-evoking information is prioritized by the algorithms because it's more likely to be read, it's more likely to be shared or liked. So this is kind of a side effect of this, that for some people, it will be the misinformation or different incitements to violence that will be seen on their newsfeed. But could the platforms have prevented it? What happened on January 6th, for instance? I believe so. There are different ways of detecting information that can be, inciting violence. There are different ways of dealing with such communications on different social media platforms. So, of course, it wasn't only, Facebook or Twitter. Those are the biggest players, so everybody's focusing on those. But, of course, there's Parler. There was Gab. And that's where a lot of organizing and very strategic communications happen about where to go and how to get there and how to break into the Capitol and so forth. So all this was publicly available and happening in front of everybody's eyes. The problem is, though, that, of course, detecting that kind of content, it's not easy, right? Like, of course, we can think like, Facebook or Twitter should be, detecting it, flagging it, or taking it down immediately. But this is not, it's not an easy job. So even though the platforms, some of those, such as Facebook or Twitter, are increasingly committed to detecting, flagging, taking down information that is hateful or incites violence, there are other social media platforms where a lot of the far-right extremists congregate, such as, again, Gab or formerly Parler, that do not take down or do not even aim to flag or identify that kind of content. So, again, the biggest platforms are trying to do their job. And, of course, we are focusing on them because they are big and part of the public scrutiny. So I don't know the extent to which that could have been prevented. To some extent, yes. But at the same time, it's not an easy job. So expecting that information will be taken down immediately after, 5 minutes after, within half an hour after it's posted, it's an unfeasible expectation based on my knowledge of how algorithms work and social media platforms operate.
You know, before we wrap up, I want to bring the conversation back to free speech, sort of following up on what Magdalena said. Nella, I'm wondering what you think about our relationship with the concept of free speech after what we saw on January 6th. Do you think that the public, that there'll be some sort of reimagining of what the First Amendment or what free speech ought to be in our society, given, you know, the spread of misinformation and how it led to the loss of lives?
Yeah, you know, you hope so. People need to be clear that we have the right of free speech, but not all speech is legal. So there's various types of speech that are not legal, including speech that directly threatens an individual, speech that defames someone's character and is a lie in a way that causes damage, and speech that incites violence or creates a hostile environment. So there are various forms of speech that are illegal. And so speech that incites violence is against the law. It is also against the law to offer support or resources to people who are trying to overthrow the government. So I'll be curious to see if some of the, I mean, I think the social media have some jeopardy here legally, and I'm not a lawyer, but from what I read, in that they're providing a resource that people are using and used in the attack on the Capitol to organize. And it is illegal to provide resources to support overthrow the government. So again, that's where I think it's partly what's motivating Twitter to ban Donald Trump's account. But I'll be curious to see if others don't start, or, you know, if social media also don't, just including Parler, don't start facing some legal trouble for allowing their platform to be used as a resource for people planning this kind of action.
Just to add that, yes, absolutely. And Facebook has also taken down Trump's profile. And kind of just to complicate this fascinating question even further, you know, social media are, so to speak, neutral. It's the use that people put them to that takes normative evaluation. So also social media were used to organize protests around Black Lives Matter, for instance, or gender equality and Me Too movement. So this is where things are getting a bit complicated, that some movements and some groups are, you know, normatively problematic and use social media platforms for organizing, but other groups and movements are advancing human rights and equality and also use social media for organizing.
I wish we had more time to talk. There's so much to unpack here, but I so appreciate you taking the time. Nella Van Dyke, Professor of Sociology at UC Merced, and Magdalena Wojciechak, Professor of Communications at UC Davis. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks
for having me. This opportunity.